Good evening, everybody.
Evening.
Now, I know there were two pieces of pizza left, but when they went around, they collected 12 baskets full of the pieces that were remaining. So there's probably some left there. So anyway, well, the series that you're about to see this evening and then tomorrow morning, tomorrow evening are part of a general series we have. We sometimes have a first round series, and then maybe a year or so later come back for a second round. But we're going to be doing a lot of those this weekend, and a lot of kind of the core ones. And I call it the Creation Weekend Safari. So I grew up in South Africa, and so I know what safaris are all about. We take one every July back to South Africa, and we take one every November to the Southwest. So it kind of puts wings to some of the things we teach, because some of those places are some of the best places of the world to see the kinds of things that we teach. So when I come to a church like this or a convention or whatever, I dress the part. I'm on safari, okay? So you're going to be on safari with me this whole weekend. And so this first one that we're going to be talking about this evening is called The Pillars of Evolution. And let's see. Is it going to be up here shortly, or is there a glitch?
Glitch.
So what we try to do, and let me introduce it while they're calling it up. The reason why I call it a safari is because if you go on a real safari, you're hoping to see the big game. Like, you want to go see elephants, you want to see lions, you want to see, giraffes and so forth. And people like to see the big game animals, when you go to Africa. It's the same thing with a topic like this. There's a whole lot of topics that are covered under this whole idea of creation versus evolution. And a lot of people have a lot of questions about them. So these seminars this weekend and our second round ones are designed to answer most questions that people would have about the whole creation evolution thing. So this first one this evening is called The Pillars of Evolution. And I call it The Pillars of Evolution because if evolution is true, we should be able to see some definitive things about it that are, okay, perfect. I'm gonna advance through this quickly. I won't use that one. All right. These are the core series that we'll do, and we're doing most of these this weekend. This first one we're doing is that bottom right one, The Pillars of Evolution, and then immediately to the left of that, The Mystery of the Dinosaurs, are the two that we're doing tonight. To the left of that are the two that we're doing tomorrow morning, and then we'll do some of the other ones tomorrow evening. So these are designed to answer most questions that people would have. And of course, if you want to go deeper, you certainly can, but that's what these are designed to do. And so we've made DVDs of these. Those are back on the table there, and there's specials if you want to get them as a set. And you can talk with my wife and Faye back there, a friend of ours. We have different things too, a curriculum that some people even use in Sunday schools or homeschool people. There's also supplementary material like the Grand Canyon and how did the Grand Canyon form? Was it millions of years of the Colorado River and all that kind of stuff? So we try to handle so many things related to what actually happened with living things and what happened on the earth, and it's not what the evolution community wants us to believe. So that's just a little bit of what's going on there. Recently we added a series of similar material for kids called The Adventures of Ranger Mike. I look strikingly like the guy in there, but anyway. I used to work for the National Park Service of South Africa in Kruger Park, so that's where I got the nickname Ranger Mike. So anyway, these are all designed more for kids 4 to 14, so in that range, and it's similar material, but all in kind of an adventure format. So that's what those things are. Okay, so what we want to do, though, tonight, we want to start by looking at this whole idea of the pillars of evolution. Why do I call it the pillars of evolution? Well, a pillar is something that supports something. If you look at a Roman building or whatever, you see these pillars that supported the roof. And so in a sense of a belief system, if somebody wants you to believe something, there's got to be some solid evidence for it, things you can really put your faith in. So there are things that I would need to know about evolution. I would need to know that these things are true before I would put my faith in it. And I didn't believe in evolution at all when I was a kid. My mom and dad taught me that God created everything, and I believed it Not even so much because they taught me that, and that made sense to me too, but still another reason I believed it is because I had a huge animal and wildlife collection. I had a huge collection of spiders and butterflies and moths, and I would study this stuff with a microscope and with a magnifying glass, and I could clearly see design in every single animal I had as a pet, of all the creatures I caught and mounted. I could clearly see design. So imagine my horror one day. I go to school at the beginning of the year, and the teacher starts teaching evolution, that there's no God and everything just made itself by chance. Initially, I thought they were telling me a fairy tale. I since discovered that they are telling me a fairy tale. But I thought they were joking. I thought in this class they were just going to be, I don't know, I just thought they were being silly, and I was just kind of, ha ha ha, yeah, sure, everything made itself over millions or billions of years, you know. Then when I found out they were serious, I was mortified. As a kid who had animals and had a collection of these things, which after all is what Romans 1:20 talks about, the evidence of things all around us. And if you cannot see design in everything around us that God made, if you can't see evidence of design, Romans 1:20 says there's no excuse for you. The Bible says we will all stand before God, and we will not be able to say, oh, I never knew there was God. He'll say, I made it plain to you. And so the whole idea of the pillars of evolution is, if they want me to believe in evolution, you're going to have to show me some solid evidence about what happened along the way. I'm just going to show you three pillars that I've developed this program around. You might have some other things, but these are major, you might call them signposts along the way if evolution is to be believable. Now, I'm going to start by telling you that that years ago I was watching a program on TV, and there was a scientist speaking. And he was talking for a whole hour about the wonders of evolution. At the end of his hour, he said this. He said, now, if you believe that there's a God who made you, that's just religion. But evolution is science. So I thought, okay, let's start with that word. Now, a lot of people are afraid of that word because they can imagine that, oh no, science is all about brilliant men and women in white lab coats doing brilliant things in laboratories, and that's part of it. But really, science is not a word that anybody should be afraid of. And I'm going to tell you why now. It just simply means knowledge. In fact, if you look at Webster's dictionary, it'll say, science is knowledge as opposed to ignorance or misunderstanding. In other words, on one side you know something, on the other side you're completely ignorant about it, or else you've completely misunderstood the data. Now, scientists don't just guess about things. They have a systematic approach to trying to find this knowledge. And there are specific steps that they take to try to gain knowledge. And we'll look at those. But I first want to give you a good working definition of science. Here's what it is. Science is the process that people use to try to answer questions or solve problems. So when you hear an evolutionist say, science versus religion, or science versus evolution, wrong. You're already starting on a wrong premise. Science has no opinions of its own. Science is a tool that we use to try to gain understanding. Does that make sense? It has no opinions of its own. We add the conclusions according to what the data says. So, science is the process that people use to try to answer questions or solve problems. I like to say that science is mankind trying to figure out how God did it. But of course, that won't fly in the secular world, so we won't worry about that one. Okay, so here are the basic steps. And by the way, there is no rocket science to this program at all. But this is the big heavy. This is the big heavy program for the weekend. So if you're still alive at the end of this program, then the rest of them are going to be a breeze. All right. So here's the deal. The first step, everything is boiled down to its absolute simple steps. The first step in the science process of trying to solve problems or answer questions is to identify the problem. You have to know what it is you're talking about. If you're a researcher in the medical field, you have to know what the disease is that you're working on, or that you're trying to cure. So you have to identify the problem. Now, in some of the sciences, in some of the disciplines, this process alone could take years for you to come up with just understanding how the problem works. Does it make sense? It could take years in engineering or medicine or whatever. But then that leads you to the next step. You come up with a solution that you think will solve the problem or answer the question. And then the third step is, once you've done that second step, and that second step might take you years, the third step is you have to test the idea. Those are the three basic, boiled down, simple steps in the scientific process. But now the tests themselves have to follow a fairly strict regimen. So if you're going to come up with a solution, then you're going to call it scientific, it must meet the following three. The tests must meet the following three criteria. The tests must be demonstrable. You have to be able to demonstrate to people what it is that you're saying. You have to be able to repeat the demonstration, and the repeatable demonstrations must be observable so other people can see what it is you're talking about. Right? Now, to make this clear, let's just pretend that you are all a researcher in the medical field and you're studying a disease that a lot of people have and there's no cure for it. So you've spent years studying the disease. Now you spent years coming up with a solution, and you think, after all your research, that you found the perfect solution in this little pill that you're going to make. You've taken certain essential oils and tree bark and tree sap and tree leaves and whatever, and you've boiled it all down into a pill, and you say, I'm sure that if I give this pill to somebody with the disease, it'll make them better. So now you're going to have to test it, right? So you're going to test it on people. You can't find just one person who has the disease. You have to find a multitude of people, because if you just used one person, you might say to that person who has the disease, take this pill of mine and see what happens. He takes it. The next day he comes back and says, I feel wonderful. You might say, yes, I knew it. I found the cure for the disease. Stop right there. You don't know if it was your pill that cured that guy. It might have been something else he was doing. That's why it gets a little more complex here. You have to have a control group. You have to have your people in two groups. This group gets the pill and this group doesn't. But still, the whole idea is you're giving multiple people this pill. You can't just give one person. You got to give the pill to 1,000 people, old, young, male, female. Give your pill to 1,000 people who have the disease. You give them all that pill. What if they come back to you the next day and they say, we don't feel good at all? That didn't work. Okay, take 2 of my pills per day for 2 weeks, then come back. They do that. They come back, nobody's any better. So you say, take 4 of my pills per day for 4 months, then come back. They come back, nobody's any better. Okay, take 16 of my pills a day for 2 years. They come back at the end of the 2 years and nobody's any better. Folks, would you say you found the cure for the disease? Of course not. Again, this is not rocket science. Somewhere along the way, either your understanding of the disease or your cure for it, somewhere you made a mistake, and the scientific method has shown that your pill doesn't work. So now you have to go back and start all over somewhere to figure out where it went wrong. That's the scientific process. Now, what if you are a really stubborn person and you say, look, I don't care what the data says, my pill works. Are you basing that statement on the scientific process anymore? You're basing it on pure stubborn faith. That's what this statement is about. Any theory that does not meet these three requirements is not based in science. It's based purely on stubborn faith. Now, let me make a statement about creation. I'm a creationist, not because science has proved it. Science cannot prove creation, because creation is not a science theory. It is a biblical assertion supported massively by the evidence. That's even the argument that Jesus used. Look at even in the miracles. Look at the miracles I've done. And if you're still doubting. So the whole point, though, is I'm a creationist for two reasons. First and foremost, I start by believing that this is the infallible Word of God. So when I open up the Word of God, the first five words, and almost any Bible you look at, the first five words are, "In the beginning God created." I have no trouble with that at all, because it's the authority of God's Word. But He doesn't just let me hanging there on pure only faith. He gives me Romans 1:20. He gives me the evidence of design everywhere. And that is one of the things we have thoroughly enjoyed researching. If you're interested, we have an email that goes out every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock. At least, I'd say at least a third of them are kind of wildlife-oriented things. Strange, bizarre creatures around the world that just show, that they just shout design. And it's everywhere. It's not just creatures. It's trees, it's leaves, it's planets, it's everywhere. Every single thing around you shouts design. So, God's Word says He created. And the evidence brought out, taught to me in Romans 1:20, literally gives me so much faith that God literally created everything exactly like He said. But now we're talking about evolution that is billed as a science theory. Therefore, it must follow the rules of a science theory. So let's have a look at that. That's going to be the balance of the program. I'm going to draw it like a building. And I'm going to say that the roof of the building, that roof structure is evolution, supported by three pillars. These are pillars that I personally, myself, would want to have answered if I'm going to have any faith in the theory of evolution. And I think anyone should. First and foremost is, where did everything come from at the beginning? Well, they say it happened with some sort of a big bang. By the way, we sometimes take tours to the Smithsonian Institute at the Natural History Museum. We were just there 2 weeks ago. It is so interesting. The Smithsonian Institute, our national shrine to evolution, has nothing anymore to say about how everything started. They've completely abandoned, or they're just completely zipped their mouths about the Big Bang. They don't even talk about it anymore. That's because so many of them have admitted, look, it just doesn't work. But that's what most of them still say. Something exploded 16 billion years ago. Like it was some sort of a little speck. Exploded 16 billion years ago, the Big Bang. And when it exploded, over the next billions of years, it blew gas and dust and everything all over the universe. And that gas and dust began to condense and form into stars. And somehow the stars began to blow bits and pieces of themselves off. And those bits and pieces were captured by its gravity. And those bits and pieces began to cool down. And we call those planets now. And on our local star, the sun, it blew pieces off, and so we have these planets going around the sun. One of them is the one we're living on, and somehow this planet, once it cooled, somehow a huge amount of water developed on this planet. We're not told how, and the Smithsonian has absolutely nothing to say about it. They don't talk about where the water came from. We got something like 360 million cubic miles of water in our oceans alone. Where did it come from? It's rather crucial for life, and we're not told where it came from. So somehow, though, in this water, there are, of course, trillions and quadrillions and bazillions of little atoms floating around, and supposedly, and they're locking together all the time. And supposedly billions of years ago, atoms were locking together all the time, then coming apart. As soon as you have two atoms locking together chemically, you call it a molecule. Well, somehow accidentally, about 4.5 billion years ago, an exact series of trillions of atoms, the exact right atoms, by the way, in exactly the right places they needed to be, formed the first accidental living cell. Somehow, and we're not ever told how this happened, somehow that first cell developed a protective skin around it to protect it from chemicals outside it. Somehow it found something to eat to keep itself alive. Somehow it figured out how to make more of itself. We're not told how that happened. You're just asked to believe that it did. Are you with me so far? This is what they tell you. This is what they're telling us. Okay, so somehow the next pillar is, somehow living things came from non-living matter. So when this little speck exploded, or however the universe came about, whatever they're believing now, somehow it's all dead non-living matter, but somehow it became alive. And then enter Darwin. He based his ideas, these first two things had to be true for him to be able to talk about what his ideas were. Then came this third pillar, that the simple living things became complex. And that's what his whole idea was, origin of species. You know, the simple becomes complex. One creature turns into another kind of creature. And the foundation of all of this is billions of years of time. Time is the backbone. Time is the miracle worker, as some of them have said. Time is the key ingredient in the recipe of evolution. If you don't have billions of years of time, even in their own minds, they cannot figure out how anything would have happened. So this is the key. Time is the key to them. Billions of years. And then these are the, as a foundation. And then billions of years of time is happening, or millions of years at least, with each of these pillars. So these are the pillars of evolution that we want to look at briefly tonight in this first section. Let's talk about the Big Bang. And I'm probably going to eventually wind up abandoning this whole first pillar because even many of them don't believe it anymore. I was so surprised when I saw that the Smithsonian has nothing to say about it. They all of their exhibits now show this big spiral. And the spiral goes back and back and back and back, supposedly to the beginning of the universe. But they don't say anything about it. The first things they begin to add to the spiral are only millions of years ago. So they've completely, essentially abandoned the first two pillars. So eventually, they're making my program going to be a little easier in the future. Anyway, so Big Bang. So this mountain, some of you will remember, before it went through a Big Bang. How many of you remember Mount St. Helens before it blew, okay? So on a beautiful day back in May 1980, this beautiful mountain went boom, and it changed that landscape forever. It's changed to this day. This mountain went through a massive explosion. But what do we learn from explosions like this? This mountain, when it exploded, did not make anything more complex. It made a whole lot of things less complex. Which is what we observe about any explosion. Any explosion always makes things less complex rather than more complex. Furthermore, you've got some major problems with this whole idea of the Big Bang. Number one, where did the little speck come from that it supposedly exploded? Where did it come from? Nobody has ever had an answer to that one. And number two, how could it explode? Because if all the matter in the universe is contained within that little speck, it can't explode because all gravity is contained right there. What's going to make it go apart? It couldn't possibly explode. Anyway, that's different stuff we want to talk about there later on. But anyway, so here you have this mountain exploding. Before the explosion, there was all kinds of living things through that region. Deer and, you know, elk and fleas and ticks and flies and squirrels, all kinds of creatures. And fish in Spirit Lake. Then the mountain went boom. Afterwards, they called it a dead zone. I wonder why. It's because explosions don't make things more orderly. They always make them less orderly. In fact, if you look at the whole universe, if this picture, if you were able to go out into the night sky and hold your hand at arm length with one grain of sand at the end of your finger, that how much of the sky would that block out at your arm length? That is what you're seeing there, blown way up. This is as far as Hubble telescope has seen out into space. You're not seeing stars, by the way. You think you're seeing stars. You're not. You're seeing galaxies. Every single pinprick of light you see, no matter how big or how small, is an entire galaxy containing trillions of stars. And you could ask so many questions. Why are some of them blue? Why are some of them white? Why do some of them have tails on them? Why do some of them spin? By the way, ask anybody that. Ask an evolutionist. Why does anything spin in space? Nobody knows. Why does it not spin? The Earth spins, but the moon essentially doesn't. We're always looking at the same face of the moon. So you look at all this stuff, and one Penn State professor once said, to get the universe to where it is now would have taken many miracles. Well, wait a minute, evolutionists don't believe in miracles because that implies a deity, okay? So if you look at that and all the implications of this incredible thing you're seeing, you'd have to say, wow, the heavens declare the glory of accident. Or, wow, the heavens declare the glory of God. Which one seems more reasonable? Now, let's bring it a little closer and look at comets. This is funny to me because anyone who has studied comets knows that they don't last very long. They can't. Because by the time you can see a comet, it's close enough to the sun that the sun is blowing it apart. That's why it has a tail. The tail doesn't follow the comet like when you see a jet going across the sky. The tail always aims away from the sun while the comet's going around the sun. Why? Because the sun's blowing it apart. What does common sense tell you is eventually going to happen to the comet? It's going to get blown apart. And they know that all the short period comets, the ones that come around the sun once every 100, 200 years or less, they can't last longer than 10,000 years. So why do we have comets if the solar system is billions of years old? All the comets should have disappeared long ago. Do you remember what science is? Science is the process that people use to answer questions or solve problems. Here's a big one. Why do we still have comets? Well, they have no idea. So some guy wound up calling it a comet nest, but that sounds too silly. So they call it the Oort cloud, named after the guy who kind of, you know, came up with the theory. Somehow out in space, there's all these comets that you can't see. And every now and then it goes boom, and some, you know, a comet gets booted out of the nest and it starts on its way to the sun. Ask anyone who believes in the Oort cloud, have you ever observed the Oort cloud? No. Have you ever demonstrated that it's there? No. And of course, then you haven't repeated the demonstrations? No. Well, then it's not scientific. It's purely in somebody's imagination. Why is it taught as though it's somehow science in the classroom? It has no basis in science whatsoever. Anyway, that's just some of the space stuff related to Big Bang. Let's get on to this one, Life from Non-Life. I have a book here. It's called a biology book, Study of Living Things. You can look through this whole biology book. You can see all kinds of things that are observable, demonstrable, and repeatable. But every one of these that I have all tries to deal with the origin of life. So let me read how this particular book reads. It says here, "How did life begin? Louis Pasteur's experiments had confirmed the principle that every living cell originates from another living cell. And if this principle is correct, and we can trace each cell back to its parent cell, and that cell back to its parent cell, and so on, well, there must have been an original cell at some time in history, and that one being the first one could not have arisen from another living cell. Could it somehow have arisen from non-living matter? Most scientists today believe that it did." Wait a minute, I thought it was fact. I thought you and me as Christians and as creationists are the only ones who believe something. Oh, this is supposedly fact. Now, if you read just these few simple pages, there's like three pages here with no fewer than 40 words like this. This hypothesis, this no, nothing has been agreed upon. They assume, it could have, it might, it could, they presume. They believe, they presume, it may have, they assume, it can, it tends to, it might have, possibly, possible. Now, do those sound like science knowledge words to you? No, those are the guys who originally came up with the idea, oh man, I mean, I'm sure that we as intelligent scientists can come up with life in the laboratory. So that's how this whole area ends. It says here, this hypothesis sparked the imagination of many scientists. Oh, I'm sure it did. So many of them went back to their intelligent scientists using controlled laboratories, controlled circumstances, trying to come up with life, trying to create life in the laboratory. Folks, they tried thousands upon thousands upon thousands of experiments to try to recreate life in the laboratory. They never even came close to the first building block. I don't know of anyone who's doing it anymore, because the only thing observed and repeatable and demonstrable is life comes from life. It's called the law of biogenesis. Have you heard of that? The law of biogenesis. Life always comes from life. It has never been observed anywhere else. So you have this whole idea of life from non-life. Now, let's make this have some fun with this, because in Darwin's day, when they looked at the cells of the body, their microscopes were very, very simple. and they could only see the cells, kind of, they couldn't really see the cell structure. Cells to them back there looked like a battery. It looked like a packet of goo with a little nucleus in the middle. So they called the cells that make up yours and my bodies, they called them simple cells. There is not a microbiologist on the planet anymore that refers to your cells, the cells that make up your body, as a simple cell. They will tell you that every single cell of your body, and folks, listen to this. Let this try to sink in. You have 100 trillion cells that make up your body. Not 100,000, 100 million, not 100 billion, 100 trillion cells that make up your body. And every one of those cells has a nucleus at the core. And in that nucleus is your own DNA. Your own unique DNA. That's why the argument that a baby inside a mother is just part of the mother. No, it has its own unique DNA. It's a human being. It has its own unique DNA in there. But every cell of your body, since it has the same DNA code in the middle of the cell, should be able to be, essentially could be, any cell in your body. But how is it that the cells of your body are all divided up into a functional parts that function as part of a whole? Just take, for example, your eye. At the back of your eye are rods and cones that allow you to see light and dark and black and white and color. And there are millions of rods and cones at the back of your eyes allowing you to be able to see. But those rods and cones have the same DNA to be a fingernail or a stomach or a muscle or a heart cell. Why aren't they? Who or what turned all that information off and kept only the information on to be a rod and cone? Same thing with any part of your body. Why is it functioning where it is, exactly how it should function, and all the information to be any other cell is turned off, right where it should be turned off? How did that happen? The DNA is like an incredible blueprint. But something or someone has to read a blueprint to build a building, right? Who or what reads your DNA, your personal blueprint, to build you? This gets to be the absolute astounding miracle of life. So, you have like 100 trillion cells of your body, and every one of them as complex as an entire city, like New York or Philadelphia. Now think about that. You have 100 trillion New Yorks or Philadelphias in your body. This should be blowing your mind about the incredible complexity inside your body. Now, let me ask you a question. When you look at a city like this, do you see just the piles of building materials? Piles of glass, piles of brick, piles of, you know, wire, you know? No, you're seeing all those things put together in a meaningful, purposeful, useful way to make a city. But even if you did see all the piles of materials, you'd have to ask yourself another astounding question. Who or what assembled the right materials? What if you just saw a bunch of piles of cotton? Can you build a city out of cotton? No. Well, who or what assembled the right materials, and who or what put it together in a meaningful way? Folks, this is one of the most horrific questions and any evolutionist would have to answer. Where did that complexity come from if it's all supposedly by random chance? If you believe that, you have infinitely more faith than I do. Because I look at that and I say, that's designed. The city was designed. So are your cells. But that's only the first problem that they have. Here is even a bigger problem. That's just complexity. So the first question or problem that they have to solve or question they have to answer is, where did complexity come from? That's the first one. Here's the second one. What is life? Do you know that no scientist knows what life is? There's nobody who can define it. We don't know what life is. We can define what living things can do. For example, if you look up Webster's, it'll say life is a certain quality, or it is a force, or it is a state. When I was growing up in South Africa, they used to say, well, a creature who can take in nourishment, excrete, grow, move, reproduce, that creature is alive. But if it can no longer do those things, the creature's dead. But that only tells me what a living thing can do. It doesn't tell me what life is. Folks, on our mission station in South Africa, my dad was a bush pilot for a hospital. So I grew up at a hospital, and I've helped with a lot of things, autopsies and everything. I've helped the doctors with things. But my dad flew the airplane. It was an airborne ambulance. And I've watched people die from all kinds of things. In this one instance, I remember there was a guy lying there. They were about ready to transport him. And he was talking with the doctor. He was alive. He was talking with the doctor. And then one moment he went, ugh, and just died. The doctor did everything he could to bring him back, to revive him. And finally he said, sorry, at 6:37, this person died. What happened? Nobody knows. Why did he die then? Why not 10 minutes from now? Why not 2 hours from now? Why not 10 years from now? What happened? His body's still here. His body is still very complex. He was just alive a moment ago. The blood is still there. Everything's there. All the complexity's there. What happened? Nobody knows, because nobody can define life. There is one place and one place only that defines what life is. And here it is, your Bible. Look at some of the verses. You're familiar with all of them. In him, who? Jesus. In him was life. I am the resurrection and life. I am the way. I am the truth. I am life. For in him, Jesus, we live and move and have our being. And there are other verses as well that talk about this. In other words, the essence of life is Jesus. He is life. There is no other place you can find a definition for it. So when he created the things, when he created man then, when he created the animals, he made them alive. He didn't give them an eternal soul, apparently, but when he made human beings, he breathed his life into Adam, and he became a living being. The only thing that makes sense is the Creator himself, who is life, putting that energy, that force, or whatever that is, into his creation. That just changes everything, because the evolutionists don't even know what it is, let alone where it came from. Now, the last pillar, simple to complex. This is where Darwin spent his time. This is Darwinian evolution, simple to complex. Now, how simple and how complex? Well, if you were to take the simplest microbe on the planet, the simple single-celled microbe that's alive on the planet, and write out its code, it would fill 2 Encyclopedia Britannicas 500 pages long. 2 of them. That's hardly simple. That's very complex. But that's the simplest microbe. But if your code was written out, it wouldn't fill just 2 books. It would fill over 1,000 volumes the same length. Where did all of that material come from? Now we're going to take that last pillar and turn it into its own building, because it has its own set of pillars. This is the essence of Darwinian evolution. This is supposedly how the simple became complex. Let's start with that first one. Creatures were able to adapt to different environments, to adapt from water to land and so forth, because the cells of their body were constantly going through mutations. And then Charles Darwin's watchword was natural selection. Natural selection was weeding out the things that weren't really productive for that creature, keeping only those things that were productive, and that allowed the whole machine of evolution to start. And all of this based on pure random chance. Nothing guiding it, because mutations are pure random chance. Now, let's look at the kingpin of this whole idea, and that is mutations. So we need to ask ourselves, what is a mutation? Let's define it first, and then we'll look at what the definition means. What is a mutation? A mutation is a mistake in the copying of genetic material. What do I mean by that? Let's make it simple. When you were first formed in your mother's womb, you were an equal amount of information from your father and your mother, and you became your own single cell. But you didn't stay a single cell. Remember, you start off with one cell with over 1,500 page volumes making up your DNA. But then it copied rapidly and made two cells. Those 1,000 plus volumes, copied rapidly again and made four cells. Copied rapidly again, made eight cells. And then you began to grow in your mother's womb. Now think about it. Think of all the material that's copying. It is astounding. Scientists have even discovered in your cells spell checkers. Spell checkers. To keep mutations from happening, to make sure the cell information is copying correctly. You thought Microsoft invented the spell checker. No, God invented it and put it in your cells. This is astounding. But still, there are some mistakes. There's bound to be some mistakes. Now, if there's a mistake, we call it a mutation. If you were to come here tonight and I would say to you, wow, you're looking like a mutant today. Okay, that's always the response I get. Why did you laugh? You laugh because you probably know enough about mutations to know that I'm not giving you a compliment, right? Because mutations, by definition and by experience and experiment, are all harmful or deadly or at best neutral. They don't do anything good or bad, but there's something wrong. I have a friend in South Africa with two thumbs on each hand. Somehow, when he was formed in his mother's womb, the information for thumb accidentally copied twice, and he got two thumbs. They could never operate to remove it because it would damage his main one. So no, he's not evolving into a great baseball catcher one day. If you were to see my friend, you'd notice he's got two thumbs, and you'd know something's wrong with him. Okay? So mutations are always harmful or deadly or at best neutral. Now, so with that in mind, let's have a look at a scenario. This is grossly oversimplifying it, but I hope you'll understand what I mean. Let's just say that you are in a war situation. You're in the military, you're in a war situation, and your commander tells you, I want you to sneak out to the front of our lines and watch the enemy position throughout the night with your night goggles. If you see them doing anything, here's a keypad. Type out a message to us and we'll get it back at headquarters. Okay, so you sneak out in front of your lines, you watch the enemy all night. At 3 o'clock in the morning, you see them all gathering and coming out of their foxholes and coming towards you. So you type a message to your commander, and this is what you wanted to type, and this is what you typed. Notice there are no mistakes. That's exactly what you wanted to type, and so this does not have any mutations. But what if in your haste you made just one little mistake, or because it's dark, you made one little mistake and typed that instead? Do you see the mistake there? You don't? Okay, you see the mistake. Hopefully you do. Okay, that's not the way you spell the. But you notice that letter A is not a new letter. It's not a J or a Z. That would be new information. That's not what mutations do. Mutations do not generate new information. They only copy wrongly, or they destroy or remove or whatever. They cannot generate new information. Now, this is, if you were the commander and you got that message, would you still know what to do? Of course you would. That's like my friend with the two thumbs. It's not hurting him from being alive or anything. It's just something wrong. The same thing with that message. Your commander will know that. Now, what if that's not the mistake you made and you made this mistake instead? Does that change anything? Well, notice it's not new information. The T was already there. But now it's been put in the wrong place. Now your commander's going to wake up and say, well, if they're not attacking, what are you doing waking me up? And he'll go back to sleep and your position could get overrun. So this is super, super oversimplifying the problem, but I hope you get the point. This is what mutations are. But we're being asked to believe that somehow mutations produced more and more and more and more complexity. That has never been observed. When you talk about mutations, I mean, look at some dogs that show normal genetic variation. But if you want to talk about mutations, I mean, you know. Okay, well, you got the general idea. Okay, so now, let me show you another way to look at mutations. I'm going to show you a code. And you know this code as the alphabet. You can take letters, members of this code, and turn them into words. So let's just take three members of this code and turn it into a word. But you notice I have to put the code together in a proper way if I'm trying to convey to you the idea of a furry animal. If I put TAC or ATC or whatever, it wouldn't make any sense. And by the way, you're reading this word in English. If I took CAT over to China, would they know what I'm talking about? No, which brings up another question. What language is your DNA written in, and who or what understands it to build you? This is just the astounding miracle of life that you can't really explain scientifically. But you need some modifiers to understand something about the cat. So let's put some other legitimate words next to that. Are these legitimate words? Sure. Make a sentence out of them. Cat, computer, floor, table. Well, okay, what about table, computer, floor, cat? Or what if I took a bunch of legitimate words and put them all together randomly, but following the rules of building a sentence, following capitalization and all that. Okay, are these all legitimate words? Am I using proper capitalization and, you know, and all that? Of course I am. But am I communicating anything to you? Look, if you put a million monkeys at a million computers for a million years and just had them randomly tap on the keyboard, you're not even going to get a whole page of legitimate words, let alone 1,000 volumes, 500 pages long, with information, with proper modifiers, proper words to build a human being or build any living thing. It's not going to happen. You have to put words together that mean something. You'd have to say, the cat is crossing the road. Ah, now you're putting proper words next to other words. Now it makes sense. Here comes a Mack truck. Oops, poor cat. So with a few simple words, you've told a little story. This is not going anywhere. Folks, mutations don't produce any kind of order or meaning. They can't. They destroy it. That's all they do. Now, no mutation has ever been shown to add more complexity to the genetic code. It doesn't work that way. Now, let's look at adaptation. Some people say, oh, creatures don't really adapt, right? That's just an idea of the evolutionists to try to get us to believe in evolution. Yes, they do adapt, and let me show you how it works. This is Dusty. This is my dog in South Africa years ago. He was a big dog, a German Shepherd Kia Sound combination, and he always looked like that to me in South Africa. He always was this way, and I came over here to go to college. I went to college in northern Minnesota. I did not know what I was in for. I only came over with a pair of sandals and one old pair of beaten up Sunday shoes that I never wore in Africa. My mom and dad said, you have to wear them on a plane. So I did. My roommate took one look at me and said, is that all you have? I said, yeah. He goes, do you know where you are? I said, yeah, Bemidji, Minnesota. He says, do you know what winter is? I said, yeah, you get snow. He goes, No, you are dead meat. I found out real quickly what 35 below zero was every single night. I found out what that was all about. Anyway, fast forward, I was going back the next year to go back to South Africa to do some short-term summer missionary work. And so some friends of mine were getting married. They're going to live right off campus. They said, hey, listen, bring Dusty back with you. We'll have him here outside. And you can come visit it anywhere you want because our yard's faced in. You can come visit anytime you want. So I did. Went back there. Was with Dusty for that whole 4 months of the summer. Brought him back with me. Put him with my friends. Now, Winter in Minnesota begins August 1st and ends July 30th, the following year. So in the middle of the year, I hadn't seen Dusty for about 6 weeks. So I got some treats, went up to the guy's house to see my dog. I didn't even recognize Dusty. He was huge, but he hadn't put on any weight. He looked like a giant pom-pom. I wish I'd had a camera. This is the only thing I remembered of Dusty. Now he was a giant pom-pom with a little black nose and two little ears sticking out. In the springtime, when I combed all that downy hair out that he grew, I filled two garbage bags with the hair that came out of him. What was going on? What's going on is Dusty always looked this way for 4 years that I had him in South Africa. The temperature never got that hot where we lived and never really got that cold, so he always looked the same. But when I brought him to northern Minnesota and he was outside in minus 35 degrees, he should have died. But he didn't. Why? Now, I'm going to, again, super simplify this. I stole my kids' Tinker toys years ago when I think that they didn't need them anymore. But it does help to illustrate the point. This is, again, super simplifying it, but I think you'll get it. Let's just say that this is Dusty's DNA code, right? Let's just say the little green stick represents his ability to grow that fine downy coat that he had in Minnesota. Okay, so when I moved Dusty from Africa to the United States, he would have died. But as the ambient temperature got colder and colder and colder, his body said, essentially, wow, it's getting cold. I wonder if I have any way to stay warm. Ah, look at this code. I can grow a coat of down, a coat of this fine, fine hair to get to stay warm. If Dusty was a terrier type of dog that has this information weeded out or turned off, Dusty would have died. He would not have been able to adapt to the cold temperature in Minnesota. Do you understand that? But because he already had the code, and by the way, where did he get that code from? He got it from his parents. Where'd they get it from? Their parents. Where'd they get it from? Their parents. The whole way back to the first created dog kind. When God first made all the different animals, he made the original kinds. Now we have from those original kinds a huge variety within that kind. Look at all the huge varieties of dogs we have around the world today. But they all came from one original dog. God knew that down the line there were going to be times when there was going to be cold and dry or hot and humid. So he put in all the animals enough genetic variability for those creatures to eventually be able to survive in all kinds of environments. And we still play with genetics today. That's how we breed other kinds of dogs. That's how we make dogs faster. That's how we make cows produce more milk and so forth. Because we're playing with the genetic code. So if Dusty did not have that code, he would have died. Because he still had it, he survived. That indicates original design, not Darwinian evolution. So that takes care of that whole issue of the whole adaptation. And lastly, let's look at natural selection. Natural selection is supposedly something that happens in nature. Our teachers used to say, oh, watch the animals that the lions kill. They go after the weak, the lame, the young, the mutant, the ones that are easier for them to catch. And they say, oh, this is survival of the fittest. And this is how evolution works. And I remember saying to the teacher, no, it isn't. That just weeds out the young, the sick, the old, and the mutant. Because the other creatures, the other warthogs or zebras or whatever, don't go on to become something else. It's just the healthy ones survive to produce more baby warthogs or zebras or impala. We don't see any kind of evolution going on there, but Charles Darwin saw something amazing in the Galapagos Islands. He saw finches. He saw all these different finches, and he said, oh, look at the finch that's on, look at the finch in the upper left there. And look at the finch next to it. And that one's living on this island over here. The third finch that lives on this island over here. The fourth finch that lives on that island over there. And Charles Darwin said, this is evolution happening right in front of my eyes. All these finches are changing. And the Christian church at that time, not understanding genetics, said, No. God said he made all the creatures after their own kind, and those finches aren't changing at all. Yes, they were, but not what Darwin needed them to do. The finches were changing, but in essence, look at the names of all of the birds. What's that first one called? A finch. What's the next one called? A finch. What's the next one called? A finch. What are they all called? They're all called finches. Darwin did not know this, but the one that with the red around it, that was the matriarch of the whole area, the large ground finch. Again, let's just use this. His code looks like this. The finch in the upper left looks like that, his code. The finch next to it looks like that. The finch next to that one looks like this. Do you see what's going on? The finch next to it, like, you know, looks like this. And by the way, with dogs, if you remove all the information, so there's no information left at all, then you wind up with a Chihuahua. So anyway, so the point is, Darwin did not know that the large ground finch there had all of the genetic code, or at least a huge amount of it, that all of the other ones had to a lesser degree. They were not evolving, they were devolving. Why? Because they're essentially getting simpler and simpler and simpler. That's the opposite of what Darwin needs. So, when it comes down to the whole idea of evolution, the whole thing doesn't work. The pillars don't stand the scrutiny of scientific study. In fact, Darwinian evolution, which is increased complexity, is not supported by scientific observation. In fact, all the mechanisms we just looked at, you know, mutations and all this kind of stuff, information is lost, never gained. When I was in Romania, my translator was also a guy with their national TV thing there, and we went out to a zoo. And he went to all the animal cages. He wanted me to make a special little video at all the animal cages. He got to the wolf pen and he said, "Mike, wouldn't this be what we believe?" He said, "Let me translate this. The wolf. In every dog on earth lurks the wolf from whom they all came." Do you get that? In every dog on earth lurks the wolf from whom they all came. In other words, the Bucharest Zoo, paid for by Animal Planet, is claiming, and they might be right, that the wolf is the original dog on the planet, because it apparently has all the genetic variabilities to it, all the genetic code, and all the other dogs have spawned from it, giving us a huge variety. That would be exactly what we would believe. In any event, all of those mechanisms, you know, mutations and everything, all lose information, never gain it. That's the exact opposite of what Darwin needs. This has become so evident that many scientists have abandoned evolution. They can't be audible about it or they might lose their jobs, as you might have heard. So one guy, this is a number of years ago, Dr. Colin Patterson, and I'll close with this. Senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in London, he wound up saying this. "One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view was last year. I had a sudden realization for over 20 years that I had thought I was working on evolution in some way. And one morning I woke up and something had happened during the night and it struck me that I had been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing that I knew." There's that root word for science, knowledge. There was not one thing that I knew about it. So he developed a question. Question is, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that's true? He says, "I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got there was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar at the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists, and all I got there was silence for a long time, and eventually one person said, 'I do know one thing, it ought not to be taught in high school.'" Now, those are the evolutionists talking. Folks, that ends the big heavy, and you still look alive.
right. Glad to have you back. You ready for some dinosaurs?